Just a quick disclaimer before we start this episode. We weren't able to achieve the typical audio quality that we'd like to achieve with our episodes. I think you'll find that this is listenable, but just wanted to give you a heads up. Cue Mr. Crosby.
Four. Straight down the middle. It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Well, welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. And Bruce Devlin, we've got two firsts today with this guest of ours. First of all, we've never had a guest that have played the broken toe card with us. And
that's true.
And secondly, this is the first guest we've had that I've actually played 18 holes of golf with. He may not remember, but I have. So why don't you tell our audience a little bit about who we've got today?
Well, he's got quite a career. 28 victories across the world, actually. He's played in a lot of different continents. 15 PGA Tour wins. And he is recognized for one great golf shot that he hit back in 1995. He hit a four-wood into the 18th hole at Shinnecock to win the Open. And, of course, now everybody knows who's with us. Corey Pavin, thanks for joining us today. It really is a pleasure to have you with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Corey, thanks for taking the time. And as we've talked about, we're here to tell your story. And, of course, that starts at the very beginning. Our understanding is you were born in Oxnard, California. Why don't you just tell us about early life in California as a young man?
Well, I grew up, as you said, in Oxnard, born in 1959. And the interesting thing, I guess, about Oxnard is there's not a golf course in the city of Oxnard, or at least there wasn't when I was born. There is now. But, I grew up and I actually started playing golf at a golf course called Las Posas Country Club in Camarillo, California, which is an adjacent city. I just kind of grew up, a normal childhood, I guess. Oxnard's kind of an area where they grow a lot of crops, a lot of strawberries. So it was kind of more of an agricultural little city. And, my parents were members at Las Posas, at this country club, a little small country club. I have two older brothers. And at a pretty early age, I was six when I started to play. I was just kind of hanging around with my brothers. And I just kind of fell in love with golf right from the get-go. I think I would have rather have been a basketball player, but it wasn't in the physical cards for me. So golf ended up being what I really fell in love with. And I really enjoyed playing golf a lot.
Did you play other sports as a kid as well, though?
I did. I played a little bit of basketball until I got to an age where I just wasn't big enough anymore. So I played through junior high school. So through eighth grade, I played. We had what we call a C team, which is by size. So obviously the A team were the big guys, and the C team, I think, was a certain, I can't remember the height, but you couldn't be over a certain height. So I played on that team and it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I was kind of probably what you expect out of a basketball player for me. I was annoying to defensively and quick and, kind of run out and cherry pick and try to get some layups on fast breaks. That was kind of the way I played basketball, I guess.
Well, as our listeners certainly understand, golf is a very solitary game. And we've heard from a lot of guys that they just sort of gravitated toward the game because they enjoyed the reliance on themselves, spending time just inside their own head. As recently as our talk with Hale Irwin, he was talking about, you play baseball and somebody's got to pitch the ball to you, or you got to have somebody throw it to you to play catch. If you play basketball, you can't make a basket unless somebody throws you a pass. You're always reliant on a team member, but in golf, it's all on you.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing I love about it. You can't blame anybody else. It's what you do on the golf course is what you get. So you can't lean on anybody as well. So it's nice that it's all on me anyway, or as a golfer, it is. I enjoyed that. I kind of grew up, I was kind of introverted a little bit. So I kind of enjoyed golf. It was a nice thing for me. I enjoyed the solitude and the, you know, rely on myself to practice and get better. You know, I just kind of enjoyed that. You know, we had groups of people that we played with at the course where I grew up. We had, you know, little junior tournaments, you know, in the summer on, you know, Saturday, Sunday morning, or, you know, every morning it seemed like we have a, like a little tournament. So we had our little group of people that we'd hang around. But all in all, you're right. It's a solitary game. And you have to work things out for yourself. And it's a challenge, obviously, to figure out how to get things done. You know, still, when I'm a 62 now, I'm still working on trying to figure out how to get things done. It's a never-ending process, this game.
So, Corey, in those early days, was there a specific individual who gave you any basic fundamentals, or, you know, anybody that you could say that was the guy that you sort of listened to most?
Well, early on, there wasn't. You know, the head pro at where I grew up at when I was very young was a guy named John Hardy, and he would do some group lessons maybe with juniors in the summer, but nothing formal. It was just kind of 15, 20 of us out there, and he'd give us a little tip about, you know, this, that, or the other thing. The first time I really had formal teaching was when I was 15. A gentleman by the name of Bruce Hamilton, who has since passed, he was my teacher. He was an assistant pro at Las Poses. He's only 7 years older than me. So he was 22 when I started taking lessons from him, and all the way through until he passed away in 2011, he taught me. So we had a long standing relationship. So when I went to him when I was 15, I was about a 7 handicap, at that point.
Good.
Yeah. And about 2 months later, I was a 2 handicap. So, great improvement very quickly. And we just developed a great rapport. And as I said, it was so many years, he taught me, and, you know, it got to the point where I could just call him on the phone and, you know, when I was a pro and say, you know, my shots are going, you know, they're doing this, you know, they're going to the right, you know, or I'm hooking it too much or whatever it is. And he would be able to give me a lesson just by listening to me explaining what my ball flight was. Hmm. So that's how much he, you know, how much we were connected for sure.
So did you play in high school, I assume?
I did. I played in high school. Oxnard High School Yellow Jackets. My middle brother, we played on the same team together, and he wasn't very happy about it. But when I was a sophomore and he was a senior, I started beating him kind of semi-regularly. But it was fun. It was a good rivalry. It wasn't like, you know, he wasn't mad at me. We had a decent team. You know, it was fun to play, and it was nice to be in a team atmosphere like that. It doesn't happen much, as we were saying earlier, with golf. So it was nice to have that type of camaraderie, which obviously led into college and team play in college as well. I enjoyed high school golf. I enjoyed college golf as well. It was fun to hang around with groups of people like that.
So you were working with Bruce pretty much through your whole high school career then, I suppose, huh? As your game developed to approaching graduation, where you started giving some consideration to maybe playing this game collegiately.
Yeah, I think, yeah, when I was 15, I was probably, I guess I might have been a sophomore in high school when Bruce and I connected up, or maybe between my freshman and sophomore year of high school. Played a lot of junior tournaments in Southern California. We had a big, it was called the Southern California Junior Golf Association. There wasn't, you know, the AJGA at that point. So we kind of had local tournaments. There was the Junior World Championship, which was kind of the big international junior event. And, you know, there was a U.S. Junior Amateur for 17 and younger that the USGA runs. But those two tournaments were really kind of the only big junior events. And I did well when I was 15, 16. You know, I was pretty good. When I was 16, I was extremely frustrated with golf. Felt like I was playing pretty well, but I wasn't getting it done. You know, I was finishing 4th, 5th, 7th in all these junior tournaments, and I felt like I was good enough to do better. And I nearly quit playing golf. I was so frustrated. That's the bad side of being competitive, I guess, is you get frustrated pretty easily. But my father, I remember him talking me into keeping at it and said, you know, it'll turn around. Just keep at it. You'll figure it out. And so I did not quit, obviously. And when I was 17, I had a kind of a breakout summer as a junior golfer. I won the junior world championship. I went to the semifinals of the U.S. Junior Amateur. But at the same time, it was my transition summer from high school to college. And I hadn't really done much. You know, people had already given their scholarships out, the coaches. So I ended up with a couple offers, and one of them was UCLA. They offered me a full ride, which was about 60 miles from home, far enough away to be away, but close enough to be close enough.
Yeah, right.
So I accepted the scholarship and really enjoyed my time at UCLA, really met a lot of people, played at Bel Air Country Club, which I'm sure you both are very familiar with. It's a fantastic country club, a really nice golf course, and an incredible membership, all sorts of people, all sorts of walks of life. So I met a lot of people there when I was in college, which is really kind of a fascinating place to hang out.
Sure is. Yeah, lots to learn in places like that. Let's go back to the moment of perhaps leaving the game. Because, Bruce, we've heard other guests talk about that. That probably, Corey, wasn't your first or last moment of self-doubt. And, Bruce, you had those moments as well, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it. I think anybody that that gets to the professional level doesn't always go straight up. It's, you know, it's sort of like a stair-step career where you think you know a hell of a lot about the game and you're about to kick somebody's butt and then all of a sudden you get yours kicked. I think that's what happens. But no, I think everybody goes through it.
Yeah, I think you get to, you know, there's certain times when you just feel like, how can I ever play poorly? And you get maybe a little overconfident and then, you know, your legs kind of get swept out from under you and all of a sudden you're playing poorly and it's like, oh my gosh, what happened? And it happens to everybody. I mean, there's nobody that's played a whole career and hasn't had downtimes. You know, maybe some have less downtimes or not as bad downtimes, but everybody's going to have them. And you have to fight through them and persevere through them any way you can. And whether it's doing it internally or externally, you've got to figure out a way to make it work.
So why don't you take us through a few of the highlights of your collegiate career in terms of events you were able to participate in and have some success in?
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
Well, my first year in college, I thought I was just going to kill it. And my best finish was near the end of my freshman year. I finished fifth at the Sun Devil Classic, which was a pretty big tournament. But that was my best finish as a freshman. Came back my sophomore year, and in the fall, I won one of the first tournaments, and we had a really good team, and our team won the tournament too, which, as I said, was a very big event. And things just, the floodgates kind of opened for me after that. I won six times my sophomore year in college. Just had a great year. It was a lot of fun. Our team was really good. Unfortunately, we actually never really did very well in the NCAA tournament. I think sixth was the best we ever finished when I was at school, which was disappointing because we were, you know, number one, number two team in the country for a few years. But, you know, you only get four shots at it, and that's what it was. My junior year was a very tough year for me, a letdown year, I'd say. Felt like, you know, maybe I should turn pro. You know, I was first team All-American and kind of I felt like I reached sort of the peak of college golf. So I had a tough year. I did not win. I was going to turn pro after my junior year of college. Got talked out of it, which was a very good decision in hindsight, that I was talked out of it. So I went back to school, redshirted my fourth year, just tried to study as much as I could and get my eligibility back. And then my fifth year, I had a really good year. I think I won five times. My senior year, again, was first team All-American. And then it was time to turn pro after that. But, you know, my time at UCLA, I learned a lot. Again, you know, ups and downs and trying to figure things out was probably one of the best things that ever happened to me, you know, having that down year. Because you learn from that stuff. You learn from winning too. But it seems like it's an easier lesson to learn when you're not playing as well. I turned pro in September of 1982 after my last year as an amateur. And I guess during all this college time, you know, a gigantic highlight for me and one of the reasons I was glad I stayed as an amateur was I won the Southwest Amateur Tournament, which was, what was it called?
North and South Amateur at Pinehurst?
North
at
and Pinehurst. South. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
I think you were there. I wasn't.
Yeah, I was like, no, that's not right. Yeah, I did win the Southwestern Amateur, all but right. the North-South was the big win, you know, at Pinehurst. And that got me onto the Walker Cup team. So I played in the Walker Cup team in 1981. One of the best places you could ever play golf is at Cypress Point. Mm-hmm. So being a California boy growing up, playing Cypress Point in the Walker Cup was incredible. It was amazing to see the golf course set up like a mini U.S. Open. So that was an amazing highlight of my amateur time.
And some good teammates, too, with Hal Sutton, Jody Mudd, and then Mr. St. Louis, Jim Holtgreve.
Yeah, Holtgreve. There's a lot of names on that team that people would remember.
The heck of a team.
And what a venue, too, for, I don't know if you had a chance before to play Cypress Point. I mean, growing up on Bel Air wasn't a bad deal, but Cypress is about as good as it gets.
Yeah, we had probably the best state amateur in the United States and California. As we played, when I was playing the state amateur, we would play Pebble Beach and Cypress Point, two rounds of stroke play. They'd make a cut. And then you'd play a third round of stroke play at Pebble Beach. And then they'd cut it to 32 players and then play match play at Pebble Beach. So it's not a bad state amateur.
Tough. Nice. That's tough duty.
Yeah, I'd had experience at Cypress Point before. And it's to this day, you know, I put Pebble and Cypress as my number one and number one favorite golf courses. They're tied.
Yeah, they're pretty good, aren't they?
So tell us a little about who, besides Corey Pavin, was involved in making that decision to turn professional.
Well, my parents, Bruce Hamilton, my teacher, and Eddie Marins, who was the head pro at Bel Air, but also our golf coach at UCLA. So we all had a sit down meeting after my junior year. You know, I was already gung ho to turn pro, and you know, the consensus was maybe it's better if I didn't. You know, I probably was not ready at that point, you know, probably physically and mentally, I probably wasn't ready. So the 2 years of experience that I had after that, you know, helped immeasurably. So it turned out to be, I think, a great decision. I think if I would have turned pro, I would have been frustrated and probably would not have done as well as I did.
Yeah.
So, Corey, during that period of time, too, you won a couple of gold medals. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I played in the Maccabiah Games in 1981 in Israel and went over and played. We had an interesting team. Some of the guys I'm still in touch with, Joel Hirsch was on that team, who was
a
pretty good amateur.
Chicago
man.
Good man. Good man.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's actually a godfather to my oldest son, Ryan. But I met him there in 1981. And Joel, of course, he was runner-up in the British Amateur 1 year as well. But a wonderful guy. And a great experience over there. We were over in Israel for 2 weeks. Remember, we all went as a group. There was probably about four or five of us that went from Caesarea down into Jerusalem and did a tour of Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And I'd never been to Israel before. Actually, I've never been there since, but fascinating trip. I mean, let alone, you know, about the golf and stuff, but the trip itself was great. And, you know, walking in as on a, you know, a national team, we walked into the stadium. I guess it was probably Tel Aviv. I don't know exactly, but, you know, we walked in, the United States team walked in. It's like the Olympics, a tremendous experience, and just loved it over there. Had 2 weeks of fun. I practiced little and won the gold medal, and our team won the gold medal, and Joel and I ended up in a playoff, and I beat him in the playoff. I can't remember if it was the first or second hole, but, you know, Joel's out there grinding, hitting balls. You know, it's 100 degrees and humid. You know, it's July and in Israel, it's hot.
Yeah.
And I'm at the swimming pool goofing around, and I'd go play 18 holes and go swim, and he'd be out there hitting hundreds of balls, and we ended up tying, and I beat him, and, you know, he's like scratching his head, like, you know, I worked so hard. Yeah. But we became great friends, and you know, every time I get to Chicago, I try to see him, and he's a wonderful guy.
Yeah, and still playing fairly good golf, as I understand it, too, in some of the Society of Senior events. So,
yeah, we played. We had a champions event in Chicago, and we went out and played a practice round together out there a couple weeks before the tournament. So it was good to get out on the golf course with him again.
So you went down to tour school at TPC in 1983 with a few names people will recognize. Pretty Willie good. Wood was the medalist. Jody Sindelar, Mark Brooks, Jody Mudd, Tom Lehman, Brad Faxon, Lauren Roberts, Zinger, Kalk. They were all there.
There's a lot of yep. good players. Woo.
Yes, it's pretty good crop of guys, you know, in that era. The you know, the one thing you didn't say is I tried in 82 and missed. I went to the regional qualifying and did not make it. I didn't even make it to the national qualifying. So I played overseas for a year. And then when I came back, I qualified and TPC Sawgrass. Six rounds on that golf course.
Well, yeah.
With all that pressure, was not a lot of fun. You know, I remember I think the first round was on my birthday, November 16th, and I shot 77 in my first round. Not a good birthday present for myself. but I managed to come back and ended up finishing, I believe, tied for seventh in the Q school, birdie 9, which was my last hole. So that got me into seventh and tied for seventh. And it's just a little side story, but the way they break the ties is your last round that you played. Okay. And so I was seventh. I was the seventh priority out of Q school. So the second tournament of the year in 1984 was the Phoenix Open. And the last tour school guy in was number seven, which was me. And I ended up finishing second.
Ooh, and nice chick.
Yeah, it was a huge check. You know, you think about it today here in 2021, it was second place was $43,200. And at that time, it was enough to guarantee me being in the top 125 right. and to secure my card. So it was a huge deal.
Yeah.
I was a little torn because, you know, we played the last hole. And three of us were tied. We're all in the same group. It was Tom Pertzer, Larry Mize, and myself. We were all tied playing the last hole. And Tom birdied it, I parred it, and Larry bogeyed it. So we finished first, second, third. So I was a little torn that, you know, I had a chance to win, and I didn't. And I was kind of upset about that. But I was also quite happy yeah. I finished second as well. So it kind of helped me the rest of the year. To just play freely because I didn't have to worry about my card. I was going to be on the tour, you know, the next year in 1985, no matter what. So it really helped me. So I had the whole year to play.
So maybe that finishing birdie at tour school was one of the most important birdies you ever made, mm-hmm. huh?
Sure.
It was. It was very important, as well as the washout on the fifth round of the tour school when I was about six over, and we had a big thunderstorm and they washed the whole round out. And then I ended up shooting 72 in the fifth round. So I had a couple good breaks. Yeah. You know, you look back on things like that and you don't think much of it at the time, and you know, it's a good break, but you look back, you know, years and years later, and you know, it's the old, you know, Steve Jobs, you know, connect the dots and see where you end up. So it's interesting always to look back and see what happens in your life and where you end up, where you are, and how that happened.
Well, why don't we recap for our listeners the professional career of one Corey Pavin. As Bruce mentioned at the top, 15 tour wins amongst the 28 professional wins that Corey Pavin had. 2 wins on the European Tour, 2 wins on the Japanese Tour, 2 wins on the Australasian Tour, and 1 senior PGA Tour win. Corey won on 5 continents. There's not too many guys that have done that. There's only about 5 guys that I think won on 6 continents, so you probably missed South America. But highest ranking second. Yeah. Highest ranking second in 1996. He was in the top 10 for almost a 10-year stretch from 1986 to 1997, so sustained good play throughout his career. What we'd like to do is just maybe take a little walk down memory lane and have you reminisce about some of your victories, maybe starting quickly on the European Tour, because you kind of got started over there a little bit, and you played in the German Open in Cologne in 1983.
Yep. The German Open or the European Tour was my second international stint, actually. So I played in South Africa in January and February. I guess it'd be the Sunshine Circuit, I guess they call it now. Yeah. I played 6 tournaments there from the beginning of January to the middle of February. I won the South African PGA down there. A guy named Nick Price finished second.
Oh, boy.
I think I played the last round and had something like 21 putts. You know, it was, I think Nick was about ready to pull his hair out. You know, by the time I finished, he was like wondering who this guy is.
He had no idea.
Yeah. He had no idea who I was. And I didn't know who I was either at that time. So, the play in South Africa made me eligible to be an exempt player in Europe, later in the year. So, and I think it was the end of June. I went to Europe and played from June to the middle of October. I remember finishing 3rd in my first tournament, Scandinavian Masters. 5-6 weeks later, I won the German Open. Again, a name you might recognize finished 2nd. I'm not sure.
It was a little Spanish kid.
Yeah,
Pedreña.
Spanish guy who was pretty good. So Seve finished 2nd there, which was pretty cool from my standards, you know, to beat a guy like that. You know, it gave me a lot of confidence. He got back at me at Trophy Lancome. I finished 2nd and he won that one. And that was my last tournament over there. I'd won a French circuit event as well over there at Calverson Classic. And then I went back home, came back to the United States in October and went to Q School. And Seattle was the first stage. I made it there. And then what we talked about earlier, I made it in at Sawgrass for the 2nd stage.
Back to the German Open, Seve would have just come off his victory at the Masters, I think, that year. Because that was 1983, yeah. Right?
83. Yeah. Did he win in 83?
He won in 83. Okay. He sure did. Yeah, he did. Yeah. Yeah, so
81, 83, or 80, 83, or something like that. 79? I don't know.
Yeah, he won in 1980, 80, I think.
In 83.
Yeah. And then I think he won in 83. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was a pretty big confidence booster for me to beat somebody like that. And, you know, and the one thing I learned about myself in that stint, that 1 year, was I loved playing overseas. I really enjoyed playing in different places and seeing different cultures and seeing the world. It actually, you know, led me to play a lot of international golf. I know there's some Americans that don't really love traveling and playing golf overseas, but I've always loved it. I've always loved traveling and to go somewhere and play golf and see culture and different places. It's something that, is really fun for me. I enjoy it.
And you had a habit of winning too when you were going around.
Maybe that's why I like going overseas.
That probably helps a little bit. But,
success could have something to do with it. We've talked about this subject of travel and the commitment it took, particularly around our discussions around the Open Championship. And even in your era, Corey, you know, you went to the Old Course in 84, I think, was your first Open Championship. And even during that time, where I'm not even sure it was official money yet, but it was a big sacrifice.
Yeah, it wasn't.
Yeah, it wasn't official money. In 84, that was my first, I guess I should say it the proper way, my first Open Championship. And I went over and qualified for it. I wasn't exempt, so it meant that much to me to go over there and take the chance and spend the money to try to make the Open. And I love the Old Course. I mean, it's an amazing place. It was the first time I had seen it, and I'm probably like a lot of people. I think the first time you see it, you go, "Really? You know, this is it? Yeah. You know, there's nothing more to it than this."
Especially the first hole. Like, especially the first hole, you know, it's sort of look down there. It's 180 yards wide, and there's a little 5-foot creek there in front of the green, but you know.
And then you play the course over and over again, and it grows on you like unbelievable. Yeah. You know, Bruce, you mentioned the first hole there. You know, it's a huge green, right? It's a pretty big green, and you play your practice rounds, and you don't think much of it, and then they put that. You know, they cut the hole about 5 yards over the burn there.
A little different.
And it's downwind and you can't get it close. And it's into the wind and so many balls go in the water. Yeah. It's amazing, you know. And it's an incredible golf course from the sense of strategic, you know, how you play it strategically. And it plays differently every day, it seems like.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like much, but boy, it can be really hard to score on. It's a fun place to play.
And it definitely grows on you. It's still one of my favorite places to go play golf.
Yeah, I was fortunate to have my first Open there, that's for sure. I loved it. I still love it.
Let's just come back to the other places you played down in the on the Australasian Tour. You won a couple of New Zealand Opens. Bruce, didn't you play in a few New Zealand Opens yourself?
I did, yeah. I won a New Zealand Open. Actually, I won a New Zealand Open, and later in they had a tournament called the Shell Open. I don't know if it was still around when you played down there, Corey, but I love to play in New Zealand, of course.
Do you remember what course you played in New Zealand? Was it Auckland or was it?
Yeah, we played in Auckland.
I know it was a few years ago. I can't even remember yesterday, you know. I went down there in 84 to play at the end of my first year on tour, and played at
Paraparamu, isn't it?
I say Paraparam, and they say it differently. Paraparaumu, right? And I played really well. I won by a few there. I can't remember what it was. It was either 5 or 6, 7, something like that. I think Terry Gale finished second, I believe. But I enjoyed it. It was a new place for me to go. And I loved it so much. I came back in 85 to defend my title, which I succeeded in doing.
Yeah.
And that one was in Christchurch. And I enjoyed that so much. I tried for 3 and I didn't get it. But I think I finished 4th or 5th in 86. But, you know, again, I just love traveling and seeing places and, you know, develop friendships that way as well. And it's nice to meet people and be with people your whole career that aren't necessarily U.S. citizens, that, you know, the different cultures. And you learn a lot about people and the world that way.
Yeah, you sure do. Bruce, I should remember where you won your New Zealand Opens. I do not, but... at the 83 Shell tournament that you mentioned, that was at Titirangi.
Yeah, Titirangi, yeah.
Yeah?
Yep. That's where I won the Open, too, at Titirangi.
Is that in Auckland?
Yes.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, it sure is.
Of course, everybody knows Corey Pavin won the 1995 U.S. Open at Shinnecock. We'll talk about that in a minute. He was the PGA Player of the Year and leading money winner in 1991. And I guess one of the thing we ought to have you comment on before we start highlighting your PGA Tour victories. You had at least a couple of caddies in your career, an early one who then turned it over to a guy you had for a very long time. Why don't you tell us about those guys?
Wow, you're doing your research. Jim Menzies was my first long-term caddy, I guess. When I played in Europe in 1983, there was another caddy I knew, and when I got over there, I asked him if there was anybody he knew that could caddy for me, because I didn't really have a caddy. And he said, well, I met this guy who's backpacking through Europe. He's from Australia. He's from Sydney. And he wants to caddy. You know, it's a way for him to make some money and stay in Europe and keep, you know, he's just living in a tent, right, this guy. So Jim Menzies is his name. So he caddied for me for most of my time in Europe. I went to the United States and I played for a little over a year. And you know, I always told him, I go, if you want to come to the States and work for me, you know, come on over. You know, we did well. So I think it was
March of 85.
Jim came over to the United States and he worked for me from 85 to 91 through 91. And we did nicely. And at the end of 91, he was done caddying and he wanted to go back home and live in Sydney, which was fine. And during that year of 91, Jim was in Europe and I came back to the States for a tournament. And then I was going back to Europe and he wanted to stay in Europe. So I asked him to find me a caddy for the one tournament that I'd be in the United States, which was Hartford. And he found a guy named Eric Schwarz. He caddied for me. I lost in a playoff, played really well. At the end of the year, Jim retired from caddying, in essence, and I called up Eric and asked him if he wanted to work for me. He'd been on tour for quite a long time, longer than me. He's caddied for a lot of really good players as well. So I asked him if he wanted to, and of course he said yes. And I felt kind of bad because I took him away from another player. But the other player was fantastic about it and said, that's fine. It's a great opportunity for you. Go ahead. So Eric's caddied for me pretty much ever since then. We've had a couple of years off here and there, but, since 91, the end of 91, Eric and I have been together and we still are actually. So, he's been a great friend, a very loyal guy. He'd
probably do more for me than I would
for him, but I do a lot for him. And he's just really a great friend. I mean, he's, you know, easily I could say he's probably my best friend. You know, we've been through a lot together. You know, when you're in a situation as a player and a caddy for that long and under a lot of different, you know, there's a lot of pressure, there's downtimes, there's uptimes, and
you can stay together all that
time. There's some kind of special bond there. And we have a nice special bond.
Yeah.
That's great.
I know he was on he was on the bag when you and I played together. It was actually in the 2010 Pro-Am before the GMO. And I spent a fair bit of time talking to him as we went up and down the fairways, probably asking more about you and your career, but he just seemed like a really, really fine guy.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's a saint in the Pro-Ams. I mean, he's amazing to watch him. I mean, he loves to help the amateurs, and you know, I help the amateurs too, and he'll take someone off to the side and work with them pretty hard. And it's a wonderful quality that he has.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway, it went smack down the fairway, then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.